hollered fun to free them. A strongly worded letter from an American Jewish physician was published in the September 8, 1987, edition of the Jerusalem Post, which is critical of American secular Jews. Legal opinion offers no hope for the Pollards. The answer has to be political. Jewish citizens of the U.S. must impress upon their political leaders the need for an independent, impartial tribunal to re-evaluate the case without resort to secret briefs and frenzied appearances by State Department representatives. It is just possible that without the hysteria, an independent court will see the truth of a case and finally free these two individuals whose main crime was Jewish patriotism. Hyman Bookbinder, in the March 30, 1988, edition of Time magazine, has replied bluntly, "Pollard is a criminal found guilty in our system of justice. It's as simple as that. If it was perceived in America that we had come to the defense of Pollard, our credibility as a Jewish community would be down to zero overnight, and Israel would be the loser." In Washington, the staunchly pro-Israel New Republic called the Jerusalem government behavior in the Pollard affair morally unworthy and politically stupid, adding that, "If the smart asses in the corridors of Israeli power think that Israel is a Teflon nation, they may be in for a shock asterisk. As we have said, the fault does not lie entirely with the Israelis. For many years they have led a Teflon existence. The political cowardice of the US government, in the face of provocation after provocation, has emboldened the Israeli government to think that they could do what they pleased, and the special relationship and the Israeli lobby would protect them from any accounting for their actions. They have become addicted to Teflon. The liquored government's attitude toward the US and the Jewish community in this country is best described as a patronizing contempt. The Israeli lobby and dual loyalty, so-called dual loyalty, is not an issue here. Whether or not it exists, and, if so, to what extent, is extraneous to the purposes of this book. If a charge is to be made against the Israeli lobby in this respect, it is if Huckabee and others are right when they say that the Friends of Israel, a term which AIPAC uses when referring to its constituents, are not true friends of the Israeli people, that they have failed in their duty to speak out against the abuses of the liquored government, that they have misled the Israeli people and caused them to believe that America supported the disastrous policies of the liquored with respect to the occupied territories, and that these false friends are responsible for the catastrophe which Huckabee feels may overcome Israel, to whom, then, is the Israeli lobby's loyalty." George Bull does not exaggerate when he said on the 60 Minutes interview, see Chapter 7, that the Israeli lobby has done an enormous job of corrupting the American democratic process. This is not to say that the motives which prompted and underlay the activities of the lobby are corrupt, or that there is anything inherently wrong in these activities as they view them. There are many rationalizations for the zeal with which the Israeli lobby pursues its objectives. The end justifies the means. There are only 6 million of us, and 200 million of them, and the ever-present specter of the Holocaust. Jewish fears, often to the point of paranoia, must be recognized. However, the concern, which is central to the thesis of this book, is that these fears are being exploited and tragically misdirected by the Israeli lobby, which is responsible for the strange attitude of the American Jewish community of non-involvement in Israel's internal affairs. In the meantime, the real dangers are being ignored. As will be discussed in subsequent chapters, the lobby's activities and its blind and uncritical attitude toward the liquored government has brought, it is often said, that Israel is the earthly embodiment of the spirit of the Jewish people, and that the fate of the diaspora is bound up with the fate of Israel. How, then, can the Jewish establishment in America take the attitude that it is not our concern how Israel is governed? American Jewry not only have the right but the obligation to become involved with the fate of Israel before it is too late. While there is still time, the lobby ought to use its power and influence to lobby the Knesset. Let it use its abundant campaign funds to support and elect candidates to defeat the liquored government. Never before has the need been so great for the moral support of the American Jewish community on behalf of the voices. In an article appearing in the Jerusalem Post, December 31, 1988, edition, "The Diaspora's Right to Intervene," Henry Siegman, executive vice president of the American Jewish Congress, provides the answer to the mystery of the strange reluctance of American Jews. To become actively involved in Israel's fate, they are intimidated by the political ploy of the Likud government, which shouts down any attempt by American Jews to offer constructive criticism, by accusing them of collaboration with Israel's enemies. Any bona fide efforts for peace coming from the diaspora are rejected as outrageous interference in the internal affairs of Israel. This Likud technique is as effective in silencing Jewish criticism from the diaspora as the anti-Semitic charges in stifling Gentile expressions of opinion. Since everybody is either a Jew or a Gentile, the Likud cleverly makes itself immune to any outside criticism. The Israeli lobby's party line, that there should be no criticism of Israel from American Jews, is no surprise, since the Likud is the lobby's client, to which the lobby's loyalty is obviously pledged. Siegman claims that, were the Labour government in power and negotiating to exchange land for peace, the Likud would not hesitate for a fraction of a moment to seek diaspora Jerry intervention, including appeals to US. They would do so despite their insistence today that to invoke such outside intervention constitutes outrageous interference in the internal affairs of Israel. And I would understand and accept their actions in those circumstances, for they would be acting out of a genuine conviction that they are preventing Israel's dissolution. What I do not accept is their unwillingness to grant to those who disagree with them as to where Israel's real security lies, the Jewish legitimacy that they arrogantly claim. The revelation that the survival of Israel is being held hostage to the in the same article, Siegman points out that the time has now come for the diaspora to play a new and vital role, and that the responsibilities of American Jewry have now changed dramatically in the face of the new challenges. These, he says, are of a quite different nature for American now. However, a new situation has been created, for the goal is no longer outlasting the Arabs. At least half of Israel, half its government, half its people, and considerably more than half its military experts has concluded that to do nothing may invite disaster. Israel's security and survival, according to this view, now depend not on maintaining the status quo, but on changing it. Maintaining American Jewish unity in support of the status quo has thus become a politically irrelevant goal insofar as Israel's security and survival are concerned, if those who see the status quo as Israel's deadliest enemy are correct. American Jewry has thus entered a new and terribly unsettling phase in which the old slogans have become irrelevant. Unity is hardly an end in itself. Inevitably, American Jews who care passionately about Israel's survival must deal with the substance of the issues, and cannot satisfy themselves with maintaining Jewish unity, if that unity serves to perpetuate the status quo. If the status quo were, in fact, to lead to Israel's undoing, it would be scant comfort for American Jews to point out that at least they preserved Jewish unity while Israel went down the tube. There are some who maintain that despite these changes, American Jews, for a variety of reasons, have no moral right to interfere in questions that affect Israel's security. In real life, however, Jews who care passionately about Israel will seek to influence what happens there precisely on issues that affect its existence, because their conscience and guts will not permit them not to. They will not stop to ask whether there exists theoretical justification for their intervention. Their deep caring is, for them, sufficient cause. American Jews no longer enjoy the luxury that they once had of avoiding policy debates on Israel, which might detract from their central preoccupation with the maintenance of a united political front in the US. Given the new realities in Israel, it could hardly be otherwise. If Israelis are deeply divided over what policies serve their country's well-being, and, indeed, its very survival, those divisions will inevitably be reflected in the life of American Jewry as well. Emphasis supplied. Chapter 9, American Jewry and Free Speech. From the foregoing chapters, the reader would be justified in assuming that the extensive and superbly organized Israeli lobby, jointly with AIPAC, speak for the entire American Jewish community. Fortunately, this is not true, but, nevertheless, they pretend to so speak and succeed in this pretension, only because open dissent in the American Jewish community is not allowed. Any breaking ranks or public disagreement with the policies of the Likud government is considered equivalent to treason. The government of Israel gives high priority to maintaining a show of unity among US Jews. This unity is regarded as a main line of Israel's defense, second in importance only to the Israeli army, and essential to retaining the support Israel must have from the US government.